This is March 7th, 2010, and I thought I would look at, offer a Buddhist perspective on the dysfunctional government that everyone's talking about now. It's hard to disagree that that we're really seem to be trapped these days, trapped in a cycle of partisan dysfunctionality that is worrisome. It's if not depressing. We seem our governmental system seems to be in a state of extremis, gridlock, where the prospects of breaking this gridlock are not great. It looks pretty difficult, and it's. It's fashionable these days to blame it all on the government, quote unquote, the government, if not in particular the Democrats. That's the most short-sighted and I think ignorant way to look at it, is just to blame it on whatever party's in power, if whether it was Democrats or when it's Republicans. Such a limited understanding of how things work. I remember before Obama was elected, and could see the tremendous hope that was generated among so many people that he would be our savior, our governmental savior, and get things moving again, and correct. The things that had gone so wrong in the previous 8 years, if not longer. I remember thinking, I may have said it in Taisho, that how can we expect one person, how can we put this on him, one person, any president, to make real significant changes? You never know. It's possible that in some perfect world that one person could generate so much change that everything could follow from that, but the odds of that are so, were and are more than ever, so dim that I could see we were really setting ourselves up for disappointment. It's a whole system. This government of ours, it's a whole system. It's a compact between leaders and the rest of us, and as is any system of leadership, that involves leadership, and it's I'm not the only one now who is coming to understand that. To just blame it on them, however we see them, it's just an ignorant way of understanding the problem, because we elect them, and it even goes beyond that. We who are not in government, we are the co-conspirators, as one writer put it in an article in Newsweek. We the people are the co-conspirators of this mess that we've gotten ourselves into in terms of public policy and the financial mess. And I agree with the person who said that the real problem is this culture of entitlement. And by that, I don't mean just the so-called entitlement programs of Social Security and Medicare and all that, but personal entitlement. I think many people would agree that our leaders, the Congress, the President, and others are paralyzed by the thought of asking their constituents, us, to make sacrifices. And for good reason, because most likely they would get clobbered at the polls. That's already been shown in the past, where the politicians who stuck their neck out and called for raising taxes, for example, were soundly defeated. And I think the members of Congress and the President, they know their constituents, that it's something of a suicidal, politically suicidal move to ask us to give, sacrifice, and give something of what we have. That's why Social Security has been called the third rail of politics, the third rail referring to the electrified rail of a subway system. Touch it and you die. And so we have this mutually reinforcing dynamic at work that really is always at work in any system. The nature of leadership is such that it depends on those who are not leading. And if a leader gets too far out ahead of his constituents, then he loses his mandate, usually in an election, and it's passed on to someone else. So this is the dilemma of anyone in a leadership position, is recognizing that yes, you have to lead, but you can't just go off on your own. Otherwise, you lose everyone else. There's a very concrete example of this here in the Zendo, and that is the playing of the Mokugyo. The Mokugyo, for those of you who are here from the workshop, the Mokugyo is the word we use for this fish-shaped wooden drum that is right here near the altar now, that keeps the cadence of the chanting. And Mokugyo players know that they have to lead. You can't just let give up and let things just go every which way. You have to lead, but you can't say if you hear that the group as a whole is a little behind the beat, a little slow on any particular morning or evening. You can only go so far ahead of everyone to try to speed them up. And if you go too fast, if they're not going to come along with you, then there's chaos. It's like an elastic band where you can stretch it some to try to think of a car towing another car, or a locomotive pulling a train. There is some elasticity to that. Cable, that tie, but if you go too far ahead, then it breaks, and then the basic connection is lost. So it's a delicate art, really. I don't know. Maybe most leaders are not so far different from those who elect them. That's why they were elected, because right or wrong, their constituents saw them as sort of the same mind. So it's not that any particular leader, even Obama, would choose to do things so very differently, even if, let's say, it's his last term in office. I often wonder why presidents in their second term don't just really cut loose and do anything they want to do. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you can't. I used to wonder that when I was a kid, but it's all, again, it's all part of the system. You can't, presidents don't have, we have this system of checks and balances, and so presidents can't just take off like dictators and do anything they want. But still, boy, if there was ever a time to do, if you thought something was for the best, for the greatest good, but it would be politically unpopular, the time to do that is in one's second term. And I'm surprised at how little of that initiative or courage is shown by presidents in their second term. So really, and then also I want to weave into this the most recent batch of scandals. This past week's has been, we've been featured, the featured state, New York State. it just can remind us that ultimately it's really not, it's not really Democrats versus Republicans. Each party seems to go through streaks where they get caught with their pants down, so to speak. But as practitioners of the Dharma, we orient to something far more fundamental, which is what we in Buddhism we call the three poisons. People are not so different. Certainly, Democrats and Republicans, in their nature, in their deepest longings and appetites and ambitions, are not different. And they're not different from us. This is the dark side of understanding the dark side of human nature. I've come to talk about the Buddhist understanding of our original enlightenment that we all have in common. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Sometimes say it's like the inverse of the teaching of original sin. This is the teaching of original enlightenment, and it is. But that's just saying half of it. The other half is that until supreme perfect enlightenment, I suppose, we all have some measure of these three poisons: greed in its many forms, hostility in its many forms, anger, resentment, and so forth, and delusion, confusion. This is what we have to work with, so that's the real problem. Does it really matter ultimately whether we elect Republicans or Democrats when the fundamental problem is our own human greed, anger, and delusion? It may matter some about in terms of public policy, but fundamentally, anyone we elect has to contend with their own impulses and their own potential for corruption. A long time ago, someone said, "Power corrupts." And we see this all the time played out in the news. So the real problem is this greed, anger, and delusion, our own defilements, and that's why I think it's important to keep that in mind as Buddhist practitioners, or Zen practitioners anyway, that we not get so caught up in politics and partisan differences that we lose sight of this basic challenge that we all face, which isn't just about politicians, but ourselves and how we elect and keep these politicians in office. And all of this really can be understood in a very, very central Buddhist doctrine called the doctrine of dependent co-arising. I first came to understand that with the help of Joanna Macy. Joanna Macy will be one of the four out-of-town speakers at the symposium that the center is sponsoring on May 1st, the symposium on environmentalism. It was a book of hers called World as Lover, World as Self, which is I would put at the place among the most important five books I've ever read in my life. In it, she lays out this law of dependent co-arising in a way that I had never heard it articulated before, and that really had such an inspiring effect to help me more than ever to appreciate how sophisticated and profound are the teachings of the Buddha. The basic idea of the law of dependent co-arising, usually this, when you hear the law of dependent co-arising or the law of mutual, they're different words for it, but usually they talk about it in terms of this of 12 links in the 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising. And that never really was nearly as meaningful to me as the way she outlined it. The other way to understand it is that there is nothing that happens. There is nothing except nothing occurs or arises except through mutual forces. You can see it just on a semantic level that you can't have a teacher without a student. It's meaningless. The very word teacher implies a student, and vice versa. A doctor and a patient, husband and wife, parent and child, elected leader and constituent. But somehow that sort of semantic understanding of it always seemed to be pretty flat and uninteresting. But looking at it more deeply with the help of her book, I came to appreciate that it's not just semantic, that everything that happens co-arises. This is really the best way to understand the teaching of emptiness, that there is no thing apart from any other thing. No thing exists except in interdependence with everything else. There's also kind of just a physical way to understand it. We couldn't be sitting on these tons, these platforms here in this room, if there weren't the floor, and the floor wouldn't be there without the ground, and the ground wouldn't be there without other physical forces. Okay, that's also right. Who's going to argue with that? But in terms of our topic for today, the co-arising of government and citizens, or co-arising of government gridlock and us. And this is really a more enlightened way to understand all of this. It's so easy to point fingers at others. There's this wonderful term in psychology called externalizing. And in psychology, it's usually referred to as the way that individuals will place blame outside in any kind of quarrel or conflict, say a marital conflict, a divorce, or other conflict, that the tendency among ignorant people is to just place the blame solely on the part of someone else. It's not me, it's that person. You know, just like children squabbling. Mom, he did it. Oh, yeah, he did it. She did it. It's almost laughable. The way we do this kind of reflexively is to place the blame elsewhere. But it is so ignorant. It's so, And now we see this with people standing up and tantruming at any chance they get. I think of the Tea Party people and others who just can't see beyond their noses. It's just always the fault of others. Now, this is not to say that it's always 50-50. Look at if you were walking down a street and you got mugged. Of course, the blame is primarily on the part of the mugger. But the mugger couldn't have mugged us if we weren't walking there. So there is, in a sense, there is a little bit of shared responsibility. And that is such an obvious case, it really is hardly worth mentioning, because in these other cases of, well, let's stick to government for now, we are so much more implicated in it than a simple case like getting mugged. I'm going to read a little bit from Joanna Macy's book, World as Lover, World as Self. I continue to be in awe of this book. I told her, well, she visited here a couple, 3 years ago, and I told her it was the most important books I've ever read. So if anyone might want to, I found it for myself. It was pretty demanding intellectually. I did not skim this book. I didn't read it on the beach. But if you can hang in there, and whatever time it takes, it delivers a wealth of understanding of the Dharma. So let me give a couple examples here. When the Buddha began teaching after his enlightenment, he was asked by what authority he spoke. And he said, not by the authority of any entity ruling our world, but the dynamics at work within our world. So you can see how that relates to our leaders now. Here's a little paragraph. According to this apparently simple set of assertions, things do not produce each other or make each other happen, or make each other happen as in linear causality. They help each other happen by providing occasion or locus or context, and in so doing, they in turn are affected. There is a mutuality here, a reciprocal dynamic. Power inheres not in any entity, but in the relationship between entities. The process nature of reality became clear. This is to the Buddha. Its continual flow, the radical impermanence of all things with no element or entity aloof from change. But the flux was not chaotic or random, for patterns of conditionality emerged. The Buddha saw how factors of existence are mutually determined, providing occasion and context for each other's emergence and subsiding. So all the factors of our lives subsist in a web of mutual causality. Our suffering is caused by the interplay of these factors, and particularly by the delusion, aversion, and craving, so that would be greed, anger, and delusion, that arise from our misapprehension of them. Hence the Four Noble Truths. We create our own bondage by reifying and clinging to what is by nature contingent and transient. But being caused in this way, our suffering is not endemic. It can cease. We're not stuck with it. The causal play can be reversed. This is achieved by seeing the true nature of phenomena, which is their radical interdependence. This is made possible by the cleansing of perception through meditation and moral conduct. The concrete analogy, the concrete image that stuck with me after I first read this book years ago, that is I found very helpful, is the Buddha referred to this law of dependent co-arising as like two sheaves of reeds leaning against each other. So picture, let's make it wheat. It's closer to home. Two sheaves of wheat that are the farmer leans against each other. Is the one on the left holding up the one on the right, or is the one on the right holding up the one on the left? And so the Buddha saw this mutual conditioning happening in everything. And his answer might have been, his famous words is, not this, not that. Can't say the left, can't say simply that the left is holding up the right, and we can't say simply that the right is holding up the left. It is their mutual acting upon each other, their interdependence that generates their that structure. I'll read a couple paragraphs that sum up this section of the book. Considering what humans are doing to their world, our use of self-reflexive consciousness is not very encouraging. I think she means just our ego consciousness is not very encouraging. But the story is not finished. As they have throughout time, systems continue to self-organize and evolve, and new levels of systemic mind can emerge. They can emerge as we work together in synergy toward common goals, weaving new neural assemblies and feedback circuits. Sometimes as I behold the ways we attune and support each other in cooperative efforts on behalf of Earth, I imagine that we ourselves are like nerve cells in a larger brain, and that brain is starting to think. Yeah, this is what awakening reveals, is that we are all one organism. She goes on, as we take part in the healing of our world, we are supported by the co-arising universe itself. Life pulses through its mind-body, taking countless forms to accompany and teach us. They exist within us in the beautiful homeostatic systems of our bile, blood, and mucus. They surround us in the ecosystems of swamp and forest and in the social systems of our neighborhoods and sanghas. We don't have to go it alone, and we can't. The strength and wisdom we need is not to be concocted on our own, but found in interaction, for that is how they arise interdependently. I think we're going through something of a dark night of the soul now nationally. Uh, that phrase came to me, a couple sentences she wrote earlier. She wrote, "We can recognize here the creative function of cognitive crisis when old habitual modes of interpretation become dysfunctional. It is often painful, a dark night of the soul, but that kind of confusion can be fruitful. It motivates the system to self-organize in more inclusive ways, embracing and integrating data of which it had been previously unconscious." She says, "New visions do not come from blueprints inside our heads that are shaped by past experience and old habits of thinking. They are born as we interact with our world and receive fresh sensations and perceptions. And for that we need earth and body, the stuff out of which we are made. They remind us that we are not brains on the end of a stick, but an organic, integral part of the web of life. Matter itself, if we attend to it mindfully and gratefully, can help liberate us from delusion." The whole orientation of Zen is to turn our awareness back to ourselves, to not fixate on what we see as others or objects out there, but to examine ourselves and to see what each one of us can do to effect change. And really, in a very real sense, it's only working on ourselves that affects change. We can't just demand that others change, certainly not without we changing ourselves. You learn this in marriage. The most foolish thing you can do is demand that your spouse change. That's what causes so many marriages to fail. It starts with oneself. Sure, we can endlessly take pot shots at Obama and Congress, the Republicans, whatever way we see as the problem. And it's not that they have no blame. Of course not. But really, what can we really do? Well, aside from what we do in the polling, in the voting booth, but until then, between election days, we have to find out what we can do. And it begins with this purification of our own mind, purification of greed, anger, and delusion in its many forms. This is the responsibility. This is why when we look to the problem, politically or socially, there may be things, certainly, where we can engage and get involved and do things. That's can only help. But meanwhile, it goes beyond that. Meanwhile, what we offer in Zen is going to the root, a method for going to the root of all this, all of the suffering in the world, in the government, in our country, in other countries, in international relations. It's all greed, anger, and delusion. And this is what we can affect, we can change through meditation. We have to, focusing on greed in particular, what will break this impasse, this governmental impasse? We have to be willing to give up some things. That is us as voters. I would cheer any politician who could see the handwriting on the wall and say publicly, "Look, we have to raise taxes at least on some people. And the most wealthy, certainly. We have to find a way to bring in more income, in addition to cutting expenses, of course. It's both." And what we can also do as individuals is learn to save more, live within our goddamn means. Is that too much to ask? That we not live on a debt, in debt all the time, in credit card debt and other debt? We have to learn to live within our means and not put everything off, the payment off to the future. This is a recipe for disaster. It's hard. We have been coaxed along for so many years by easy credit and other ways and all of the unbelievably powerful enticements of our consumer culture. But we're running up against the limits of it, and something has to change, and it's got to start with each one of us. Well, those are my thoughts anyway. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.